Dr. Schultz will address us this afternoon on a very provocative, very important, and a very difficult subject, namely the subject, the pastoral office and other offices. Dr. Schultz.
It was delightful to hear Pastor Barth this morning, as he indicated he and I have known each other and worked together for a long time. And in addition to his wise words, I certainly would commend him as a model. Maybe he wouldn't like to hear that, but I think his conduct of the pastoral ministry is indeed a model. Well, he settled us down this morning and gave us a sense of pride in the ministry. I may totally confuse you this afternoon, and I dare say that many of the things I have to talk about will certainly not be finished. A whole book could be written about the subject of the relationship of the pastoral office and the other offices, particularly the long history of the underground war which has gone on within our Missouri Synod, generally not officially recognized, between pastors and teachers. This issue of what is a pastor, you know, you go home and somebody says, what are you doing? And you say, I'm at a seminary and I'm going to enter the ministry. Well, the chicken who was eaten by the pastor knew that he was entering the ministry. But what does it mean to enter the ministry? What is it? Very recently, over in Concordia, Missouri, I addressed the Missouri District Pastoral Conference on a topic very similar to this, except I had 6 hours, and we just barely scratched the surface, so you know what to expect. I started out by asking that group of notable clergymen who, by the grace of God, have been called to the center, the dead center of Lutheranism, Missouri, what is unique? What is the uniqueness of the pastoral ministry? And I was interested to see that I had dead silence for quite a while. And that we had a difficult time. We spent a half an hour, then finally people began to talk up. And there was no general consensus on what do you mean by a pastor and what sets him apart from everybody else. Some people said, well, he preaches the word, and I pointed out other people do that too. Some decided that the only unique thing that he did, which nobody else was allowed to do, was to consecrate the elements in the sacrament, because they discovered that everything else that he did, somebody else did too. And this is part of the problem. So if we are somewhat confused, join the crowd. There have been numerous studies. Presently, in the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, we are working on a document. I'm not sure that we'll publish a document. We plan ultimately to discuss it with the Council of Presidents, with pastoral conferences and others in the church, because the entire question of what is the clergy and what are these offices in the church needs some explanation. Back in 1973, the New Orleans Convention of the Synod, if you'd look in the workbook in the back, there was a paper published at that time. It was not even called a position paper. It was merely called a report by the CTCR entitled The Ministry in Its Relation to the Christian Church as Seen on the Basis of Holy Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions, with applications to specific problems of the church in our time. That's the title, not the paper. And this document, which is probably better forgotten and may even be withdrawn ultimately, I think merely added to the confusion. It came out suggesting the ordination of called male teachers, and then asked Synod to appoint a committee to figure out why we couldn't also ordain the women teachers of the Synod, so that the whole doctrine of the ministry, and also that which is not doctrine, which is practice, such as our nomenclature, has become confused in recent years. Now, you're going to discover that when I read a paper, I don't read it. I read for a while, and then I get off the track, and I discuss it, because there's so many things here that we need to examine. It may be a bit unnerving for an audience of theological students to realize that the definition and distinction of, quote, the pastoral office is a matter of debate. When I was a child, we thought we knew what a minister was and who he was. When someone in a rowdy precession of the confirmation class yelled, "Jiggers, the mini," we knew who would be next through the door, and everybody else did. Today, we are less certain. Many questions regarding the ministry are engaging the attention of the churches, and certainly not only our own church. In the Lutheran Episcopal dialogue, which has been going on, also the Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue, which has been going on, the doctrine of the ministry has been very central to the discussions. It is not only the hot issue of the ordination of women to the pastoral office, which is arousing curiosity and inciting debate. In fact, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, that is not the issue concerning the ministry, which is on the front burner. It gets in the papers once in a while, but I really feel it is not disturbing very many people. But we do have other issues which are. Recently, I attempted to draw up a list of questions relating to the doctrine of the ministry, or the practice of the doctrine. These were drawn from correspondence which we received in the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, and from our own participation in various study groups which are investigating the phenomenon known as clergy. Within recent memory, the Division of Theological Studies of the Lutheran Council in the USA investigated the matter at length and produced a document purporting to express a consensus of the major Lutheran bodies in our country regarding the doctrine of the ministry. And this ended up in considerable confusion. The LCA, incidentally, has a much stronger view of the ministry. As you know, their practice is different from ours in that after the men graduate from the seminary, they are ordained by the synod, which would correspond to our district. And then they receive their calls and are installed, but they are inducted into something called the ministry, whatever that may be. And are not as strictly, do not as strictly relate entering the ministry with the call of a congregation as we do. And then we ended up in that Lacusa document by trying to find a whole batch of new words for not only teachers, but deaconesses, directors of Christian education, and we got all the way down to a Christian who is a social worker and not working for the church, but who also should receive some kind of induction into office. I've mentioned the 1973 document of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Among the questions which I presented to our subcommittee on the CTCR, which is presently charged with providing guidance to the church regarding the doctrine and practice of the ministry, are the following. And you can check these out and see how you would answer them. Is there a uniqueness in the concept of the ordained pastoral ministry as an office, as opposed to either an ontological concept or a functional concept? Is there a distinctively Lutheran confessional concept of ordained ministry? And if so, what is the scriptural and confessional evidence? And that sounds real easy until you start trying to do it. I think in the history of this concept of the ministry, you've had, as I see it, three basic positions. The one I've called ontological, which would be reflected primarily by the Roman Catholic view of the character indelebilis, the indelible character, that there is something up here, a platonic essence into which you are injected, so that you can be in the ministry, whether you are serving or whether you're doing anything, you're just sitting there. As long as you're breathing, you are in some kind of state called the ministry. The functional view is the opposite one. That would be probably called the far left view. And that is that ministry is just something that some people do. If you decide to become a professional and you preach and you make sick calls and you visit the mothers in the hospital and eat their candy and do a few other things, may even include cutting the grass, you at least work in a church building and live in a parsonage, that the ministry is merely some things that people do. The other, the middle question, which I think is basically the Lutheran position, is that there is, by God's ordination, an office of the ministry. And in abstracto, perhaps, we can think about it. But God had decided, and in his grace and mercy has given us his word, the Bible, as a marvelous gift from God. He has given us the sacraments, and in addition to that, not as a means of grace, but as a means to communicate the means of grace, it was God's idea that the church should also have the ministry. And we'll have to examine in a little more detail exactly what we mean by the ministry, because that's where the argument has been. That's only the first question. I've got a whole raft of them that you could develop a whole seminary curriculum around these, I think. What is the uniqueness of the ordained pastoral ministry? What, if anything, differentiates it from other ministries in the congregation? Are there actions which may be performed only by an ordained pastor or under the immediate supervision of a pastor? Some of the practical things which are occasioning these questions, for instance, are emergency situations where laymen are being given six lessons from Madame Lozongo or something, and are told, now you may go out and preach in this obscure little mission station. And the next question is, well, since I'm there and the nearest pastor is 200 miles away, may I also celebrate the sacrament? And district presidents are scratching their heads and asking, well, why not? Or maybe. When I was a child, if you set foot in the sanctuary, in the chancel area of the church, which you didn't do, but you understood that if you did, God would get you. You know, a thunderbolt would come down from heaven and you would be a shriveled ash. And if a layman addressed the congregation, he definitely stayed down on the floor of the nave. He did not take those two steps up into the chancel area. And later on, we modified that and said, well, he can stand behind the lectern, but not the pulpit, for heaven's sake. You know, the heavens will open and pour down some kind of fire if he enters the pulpit. So we've had, I suppose, traditions and feelings, but still an uncertainty. What is the significance of the phrase employed in our page 15 communion liturgy? As a called and ordained servant of the word, and in the stead and by the command of my Lord Jesus Christ, I forgive you your sins. I say it out of Chapel of the Cross, although I have some uncertainty in my own mind whether at this moment I'm called and ordained. I'm sort of hired out there to help the pastor. I was ordained, but you can begin to see the confusion that enters in. And what exactly does that mean? Fourthly, what may a vicar do and what not? And we've had discussions there. When I vicared, it was against the rules for a vicar to even assist with communion. But as my bishop said, if that's forbidden, so were apples in the Garden of Eden. And I did it anyway, but I didn't want the seminary to know about it. And certainly a vicar may not consecrate the elements. Is there such a thing as being ordained into the ministry? That is there such a thing as ministerium generalis or the ordinatio generalis? And who confers that status? We've got all this confusion now of whether the sovereignty of the congregation means a single congregation somewhere can decide all by itself who is or who is not a clergyman of the church without reference to the rest of the synod? Or is it necessary that there is such a thing as the Gesamtgemeinde, a larger church, which must be included in the decision of who is or who is not ordained? The whole business of ordaining or not ordaining Seminex graduates has roused this issue, brought it right to the fore. And congregations have said, district presidents have said, all you need to enter the ministry is to get one congregation to call you as its pastor, and thereafter you are a Lutheran clergyman the rest of your life if you continue in the work of the church. Confusing, isn't it? Is ordination unique to the office of the pastor? May we ordain teachers, DCEs, deaconesses, or as some congregations do, even Sunday school teachers? Are called and ordained, they're given a certificate of call for a year, and they are ordained. Is there a difference between installing, ordaining, commissioning? Or has our nomenclature become so confused that we can no longer differentiate authority and responsibility of the various offices of the church? Other interesting questions arise. We won't be discussing them, but they are on the fringes of the basic issue, which we will be discussing. And in some respects are very live issues in the church today. Is a full-time district president called? Wow, that's one for you. And it has been a matter of concern for the Commission on Constitution and others. Some district presidents have said, when I was elected at the district convention, that is a call. And you dare not, nobody except the people who called me, and they, for proper reasons, can unseat me. Dr. Price has had to struggle with that one, as you can well imagine. What about a district executive or a seminary professor? We even see the problems that are created here when we start talking about conducting communion services. We presently have this kind of new arrangement where some of us have been asked and have agreed to be the pastoral staff of this seminary, and on that basis are conducting communion services. Although, to safeguard everything, we got Pastor Warnick to make sure that his church is sponsoring us. Again, you can see the confusion that we have found ourselves in. Is it necessary that a call to a pastor always be with unlimited tenure? Remember, years ago, when we were short of calls, and you should have been around then when we sweated out every last student, a number of calls were offered that were for 1 year or 2 years. Some of the tent maker calls, as they were called, where you were promised a job at driving a truck 40 hours a week, and on Sunday you conducted worship services, and then we kind of blessed that whole thing by saying, well, St. Paul made tents, didn't he? And there were students who turned down some of those calls for reasons of conscience and doctrine. There were also some who said, I will not accept the call, which is for 2 or 3 years, because I don't believe it's valid, which is what we have been taught. You'll find that in Dr. John H.C. Fritz's Pastoral Theology, so that you couldn't blame students who had read that from worrying about whether that was a divine call. Well, other things, does it matter who distributes the elements in a communion service? Not consecrates, but distributes. And here we, not too many years ago, some congregations haltingly put a toe in the water and allowed the teacher to help out. But it had to be a teacher, and he had to have a choir robe on. Now we find, for practical reasons, very often we have lay people all over the place distributing the elements. Were we wrong before and right now, or where do we stand? And one that we got even a long letter from one district which wanted us to investigate the question of whether or not it is proper for a girl to serve as an acolyte. And there are congregations which would be horrified. On the other hand, I see more and more of it. So you can see the whole host of very practical questions which revolve around this question of the relationship of the pastor, whatever that is, to the other offices in the church, whatever they are. So these questions, most of which we can't enter into, at least relate to the assignment. So I'd like to lay out for you, first of all, the central issue, and then I will take a stand on it, and thereafter discuss some pastoral theology. And I'd like it to be known, first of all, that my concern, particularly for that vast group of professionals in our church called teachers, is a very real one. For a number of years, I was known as the great white father of the teachers of the Eastern District, and learned to know them very intimately, and the real pain and agony and uncertainty which inflicts many of our teachers as they try to ask themselves, who am I, what am I, and what does the church think I am? Frequently at Springfield, and the same may be the case here, we would have principals or teachers who would come in and say, now I want to study at the seminary and become a pastor. I used to ask them why. And if it was because they despised their own office as teacher, I was very leery about accepting them, because I felt they had to come to terms with that first. In many cases, they showed a great respect for that office, but wanted a greater challenge as they saw the pastoral office. But it certainly is true that we have broken many hearts in our synod by not carefully delineating and respecting the office of the Christian teacher. So I want you to know that whatever I say comes from a deep personal knowledge of that pain and a tremendous sympathy for it. Well, it's a crucial issue in our synod. The relation of the pastoral ministry to other ministries is of special significance in our synod. We have more women ministers than any other Lutheran synod, which fact we used to sort of rub into the faces of the ALC people when we were arguing about the ordination of women. We reminded them that we weren't against women ministers. In fact, we had more than anybody. Than anybody other than the Roman Catholic Church. Approximately one-third of our parishes include a Lutheran elementary school as an essential part of their gospel ministry. You may end up in one of them. This is one reason why in our education course around here, we'd like to get you out into the Lutheran schools of the area. In case you end up being pastor of a congregation with a school, you'll at least know what they're like and who is running them. In addition, we have a growing number of people who serve as directors of Christian education or youth directors. In my experience, the relation of the pastor and the DCE has raised the issue of the relationship of various ministries to prominence in our practical church life. Not too long ago, I delivered a paper up in North Dakota to a group of teachers, DCEs, and a few pastors, and the whole thing was occasioned by the fact that in one congregation, the pastor and the DCE had gotten into each other's hair. And the DCE convinced the voters' assembly to pass a resolution indicating that they were equal, that the DCE did not have to report to the pastor, and that in effect he was answerable only to the church council and to the voters, which created all kinds of fussing and stewing in the congregation. I'm not sure. I think I convinced everybody except the two people who were arguing, and that was why I was invited. The problem of the relation of pastors and teachers in our synod has plagued us for decades. I've come to understand the frustrations of this marvelous corps of teachers. They have asked whether they are auxiliary, which is a word that Dr. Walther used, and there's a discussion now about what he meant, or are they subordinate, and if so, is it bad to be hypotagoi, as the Greek has it, to be subordinate? What does it mean? And are they inferior to the pastoral ministry? The problem, of course, has been exacerbated by our relations to the government. This issue has arisen a number of times. 1869, and you'll find that at that time a man named C.A.T., I guess lovingly known as Cat Sully, produced some writings which are still available, indicating pretty much the position of the Senate at that time. In 1959 and 60, the whole issue of whether or not a teacher is a minister arose in connection with two areas of government. First of all, the IRS questioned whether or not a Lutheran parochial school teacher has the right not to pay taxes on his housing allowance, as pastors are. And the government kept asking, are they ordained clergymen? And we kind of choked at that. The BPE prepared a brief in this famous Egan case, because it was a teacher named Egan, E-G-G-E-N, who around whom it revolved. We kind of choked and said, well, no, not ordained exactly, but they do some nice church work. And the IRS said, "Tain't good enough." So then we got a hold of a smarter lawyer, and he went, first of all, the case was tried up in Detroit in that district, and then ultimately in Washington, D.C., and we decided, now, yes, indeed, they are ministers of religion. And the IRS, I guess, got tired of arguing the case, and they said, okay, that's all we wanted to know. But we got around saying they are ordained clergymen, because we didn't want to say it. The other problem revolved around the matter of the military draft with the Selective Service. Is a male teacher who may be 21, 22, and who otherwise would be draftable, is he now a clergyman? Can he be 4D? 4F? I don't know. 4F, I guess, is when you only have one leg. 4D. Crazy people and preachers. Our teachers were, many of them were on the verge of being drafted. So once again, we had to deal with the federal government, and the same question arose. Well, clergymen are exempt from the draft, but are they clergymen? Or what are they anyhow? And again, the answer came forth, the question was again, are they ordained clergymen? And we harumphed around and said, well, not exactly, but... And we finally came up with a formula again. There are ministers of religion which the Selective Service system brought. But I think those two problems raised the issue for us and forced us to face up to this question of what is the relationship? We think we know what a pastor is because he wears a collar and sometimes and he does certain things. He alone stands in the pulpit. God help anybody else who gets in there, and a number of other things. But when it comes to what the ministry is, we have problems. Okay. In recent synodical conventions, the issue of the relation of pastors and teachers has surfaced in memorials, requesting again and again that synod ordain teachers, and that teachers be given a vote at synodical conventions. And we got Steve Schmidt's little monograph put out by the Lutheran Education Association, The Powerless Pedagogue, and the title alone tells you the story. As things now stand, teachers are not laymen, nor are they clergy, I guess. They are advisory members of synod with the right of representation at conventions. They may speak, and we keep... telling them, well, that's okay, it doesn't matter whether you vote or not, as long as you can speak. And usually they buy it and they settle down again. But we do have that problem. The basic premise of the balance of clergy and lay votes at a synodical convention seems to have left teachers in a state of limbo. Hence the question which you are facing on this day of theological reflection. Now, the issue, it has been joined a number of times, and I would encourage you, because we can't say it all today. As I said, this topic needs a whole book. I would encourage you to do some reflecting, discussing, and reading. Some of the items on the bibliography which Pastor Barth gave you are very good. The issue is most clearly joined, however, in two writings which are years and years apart. And the one is Dr. C.F.W. Walther's Kirche und Amt, Church and Office. And Pastor Barth quoted a number of the theses of Dr. Walther, which pretty well established the position of the Missouri Synod regarding ministry for a long time. More recently, that position has been challenged, and quite particularly in this book, in which I have some papers, entitled The Ministry of the Lutheran Teacher, which was written by Dr. Arnold C. Miller. And you may not know who he is, but my guess is he touched your life many times, because for years and years he single-handedly wrote the Sunday school material. I think they had a big log chain down at CPH and had him chained to the desk. And he wrote everything from the nursery stuff up to the Bible class stuff for a long time. He himself is an ordained clergyman, and yet having worked with the Board for Parish Education and teachers was very sympathetic. And that little study is, I think, very restrained. I think it's intelligently done, and yet it does indeed challenge some of the issues which we took for granted, and most of which stem back to Dr. Walther's work. Very clear, if you read a little German, and I'll probably read some of it to you to show you how easy it is in a moment, a very good explanation of the position of Dr. Walther and the church at that time, you'll find in Eckhart's Homiletische Reallexikon, which is in the reference section of the library, published in 1913, and which I think very clearly spells out. You look under it's alphabetized. You look under Schule, school, or Schullehrer, school teacher, where this discussion takes place. I think that's in volume 5, and there's something in volume 8 also. But any topic having to do with teachers, particularly of the schools, gives you the position. So Dr. Miller has an opposite point of view. He even has the audacity at times to suggest that maybe Dr. Walther made some mistakes. Simply put, the issue is this. Is the pastoral office in the church alone divinely ordained, and is it superior to all other offices in the church, so that any other office is subsidiary and auxiliary? And it's easy to quote Walther and even the Confessions, das Predigt Amt, the office of preaching, ist das höchste Amt in der Kirche. Punkt, period, that settles the matter. That's where we are. The preaching office is the highest office in the church. And if you got a teacher who starts feeling his oats and doesn't do what you want him to do, just throw that at him. But it doesn't settle the matter, because the question still arises is, what do we mean by Predigt Amt? On the one hand, there's a strong tradition in our church which elevates the pastoral, that is, the office of pastor in a residential parish. And this leaves everybody else out. This leaves us seminary profs out. It leaves missionaries out, mission developer. When I was in New Jersey, I went to the New Jersey District Convention. Even though I was serving a parish, they asked me whether I had accepted a call to that parish, and I said no, I was still under the call from the district, and they said, you can't vote. So, okay. So we're talking, and I think that illustrated what I'm talking about, that there is a mystique about the pastor of a residential parish where you can actually count votes and see heads on Sunday morning and whatnot. Here are a few of the quotations from Eckhart which bring out where we stood. Es gibt bloß ein Amt in der Kirche. Wow. There is really only one office in the church. That's praise up, the office of preaching. Aus dem alle anderen empty fließen, out of which all other offices then flow. Dieses Amt ist das höchste Amt in der Kirche. There it is again. We said that over and over again. This office is the highest office in the church. And what about the office of the teacher? Well, that got a little bit of put down. Das Schulamt ist doppelter Natur. The office of teaching in the school is of a double nature. Insofern es mit dem Unterricht in Gottes Wort zu tun hat, to the extent that it deals with instruction in the Word of God, ist es ein öffentlicher, kirchlicher Amt. Then it's a public, churchly office. Oder ein Teil des Predigtamtes. A part of the preaching office. And you can begin to see some of the confusion that enters in. First, it flows out of the preaching office. Now it is a part of the preaching office. And on the other hand, insofern as weltliches Wissen lehrt, to the extent that it teaches worldly knowledge, ist das ein privat, bürgerliches Amt. It is a private, civil office. The same as a public school teacher down the street. Das an der Stelle der Eltern verwalten wird, that is exercised in the place of the parents. So that probably confused any teacher who picked up Eckhart's Real Lexicon and wanted to find out what he was. Again, so friend das Schulamt got its work right to the extent that the office of teaching in school proclaims the word of God, ist das ein vom Predigtamt abgezweigten Hilfsamt. Well, that really nails it down. Now, again, it is rooted in, or it grows out of, it is a branch out of the preaching office as an auxiliary, a Hilfsamt, an auxiliary office. Or darum folgte, dass der Lehrer an der Hilfe des Pastors ist. The teacher is a helper of the pastor. And the implication is that he takes his orders from the pastor. Now you begin to see why this question that you've asked me to explore, the relationship of the pastoral office to the other offices, is important. If you become a pastor of a school, and you have of a congregation with a school, you have five or six teachers, what is their relationship to you? Are you going to walk in there and say, I'm top man, and you don't do anything without talking to me? The worst case of that I saw happened in a congregation in Pennsylvania, into which I was called, and I think I spent half my life there trying to settle this thing until finally somebody left. The issue started between the pastor and the principal over who had the authority to decide whether or not there was enough snow to call school off. And, you know, I felt the same way. Good grief. You know, how crazy can it be? But it escalated. It divided the congregation. It put that congregation into misery for 5 years. And ultimately, I came down one time, and the pastor said, I got it all fixed up. He said, you come to the voters' meeting with me and you'll get this thing passed. And I said, what have you got? And he brought out 3 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, single space, in which he spelled out everything that he was going to have authority to do and everything the principal would have authority to do. And I said, you're going to take that into a voters' meeting and get this congregation even more mixed up? And I ripped it in two. I said, because if you have to have this kind of a relationship with a fellow workman in the church, forget it. That is legalism at its worst. Well, but his point of view was pretty much this. He would have said, if he had remembered any of his German, which I don't think he did, so von der Schulamt Gottes Wortrat ist es ein vom Predigtamt abgezweigten Hilfsamt. You are you work for me, not for the congregation. My office is the top of it. Darum folgte, dass der Lehrer an die Hilfe des Pastors ist. He's an assistant to the pastor, not an assistant pastor. Isn't that cute how we managed to get around some of these things. Der Pastor der Seelsorger auch der Kinder und der Aufseher der Schule, Aufseher der Schule bleibt. The pastor is the Seelsorger of the children, not the teacher. And he is the superintendent, der Aufseher der Schule. He is the superintendent, or he remains the superintendent of the school. And that has been an issue. There are endless articles around the, what is the pastor's relationship to the school? And for quite a while, we kind of like that expression. He's the superintendent. He may have only one classroom and one teacher, but he's on the same par with the superintendent of schools in St. Louis. Auch Seelsorger der Gemeinde liegt ihm ob, für christliche Unterricht seinen ihm befohlenen Kinder zu sorgen. And as Seelsorger of the congregation, it remains his responsibility and his job to be for the Christian instruction of the children who have been committed to his care, which kind of leaves the teacher out and dangling out here again. And there's an interesting Anmerkung there. They've got, Eckhart's got little notes. Seelsorger an den Kindern außerhalb der Schule gehört nicht zu den Amtspflichten des Lehrers. Taking care of, you know, showing spiritual concern for the children, it has nothing to do with the office of the teacher. Sondern ist nur Liebespflicht. That is, if he does it, if a kid gets in a hospital and he calls on him, that's merely the same as anybody else doing it. It's a duty of love. But it is not. He has no business, really, showing concern for the spiritual welfare of the child. And the reason for that, of course, is if he does, he's intruding into the pastoral office. Well, it's little wonder that we got some confusion. And finally, das Schulamt ist dem Predigtamt nicht koordiniert. The teaching office is not coordinate on the same level with the preaching office, sondern untergeordnet ist. Der Lehrer ist unter die Inspektion des Pastors gestellt. And that, you know, that's the last straw. Now, the teacher has been placed under the inspection. Not really the supervision, but the inspection of the pastor. So, Eckhart's discussion in his homiletische Reallexikon, under the notation Schuller underscores the confusion which has plagued the church concerning the doctrine of the ministry in this regard. And we've had it, you know, this is one of the most, if you get into the doctrine of the church or the doctrine of the ministry, don't be too glib because you're entering a thicket. And if you're not careful, you'll never emerge. Willem Lehrer's view reduced the priesthood of believers to a point where it seemed to be merely the right of direct access to God. And regarding the ministry, his view was expressed in this way. Das Predigtamt steht in der Gemeinde wie ein fruchtbarer Baum. The office of the preaching office. I'm going to keep using that term because I'm going to point out one of the problems here is what do we mean by Predigtamt? So the preaching office stands within the congregation as a fruitful tree. Der sich von selbst fortpflanzt. Which plants itself further on. The ministry itself, without reference to the congregation, continues itself. Nur wer das Amt hat, kann es übertragen. Only he who has the office can possibly pass it on. Und das geschieht nicht durch Beruf, and that doesn't happen through the call, sondern durch die Ordination. Well, the lawyer was quite influential in the early days of the church at Springfield. We kind of liked him better than people do around here, I think, because we always dated the establishment of that seminary in Fort Wayne from Lehrer, that he encouraged it to develop practical preachers because we needed them in a hurry. I won't put in any plugs for Springfield. I've got a few. And since I'm working here now, I've forgotten most of them. I used to have some dandies that could zing St. Louis. Did you know, for instance, that for many years the Springfield Seminary produced most of the pastors, but many more than St. Louis did? That's because everybody was studying Hebrew and Greek and classical stuff and reading about the black ships and the Odyssey and so on. It took a longer time to get geared up. Okay, others have tried to distinguish between church offices which flow out of the public pastoral ministry and those which do not. Those which do not flow out of the pastoral office are called auxiliary. The office of teacher in a parish school is considered as flowing out of the pastoral office. It receives its legitimacy from the pastoral authority. Such offices as professor, missionary, district president, circuit counselors, and so on, do not flow out of the pastoral office, it is said, and thus are lower in authority. And yet even here, the office of teacher is subsidiary to that of the pastor. And that view kind of raises the office of the parochial school teacher, but it really gets to us seminary profs and says we really have no connection whatsoever with the pastoral office. In short, a tradition in our church body is expressed in these words, das predigt amt ist das höchste amt in der Kirche, alle anderen Ämter sind bloße Hilfsämter. All other offices are merely helping offices. Well, then came Dr. Arnold C. Miller, who let out a big yell in the ministry of the Lutheran Church, and he said, "Tain't so." And in one of his pages, he said, "If I have to say Dr. Walter made a mistake, so be it. If this be heresy, you know, then the torpedo's full speed ahead." And then he kind of backed off and decided Dr. Walter couldn't possibly have made a mistake. Everybody else had just been misunderstanding him. Dr. Miller clearly identifies the point of conflict on page 11 of his book. "Readers will find it easier to follow my method of dealing with the subject if they know at the outset that the confusion referred to has been caused by conflicting views regarding the nature of the ministry. My purpose is to clear up this confusion." I'm not sure he kept his promise, but he sure tried hard. "Two views of the ministry have been propounded among us, and they are mutually exclusive. It is an either-or. According to one view, the pastorate is the one divinely instituted office. All other positions in the ministry stem from the pastorate and are auxiliary offices to the pastorate. According to the other view, which I believe is biblical," the biblical one, still Dr. Miller speaking, "God has instituted the office of the ministry. That is, he has commissioned his church to proclaim the gospel and administer the sacraments. But he has not prescribed the forms in which the church is to fulfill the commission. All forms of the ministry, including the pastorate, stem from one divinely instituted and all-embracing office of the ministry." Now, at least that's a very honest, you don't often find statements of the issue that clearly presented. In his book, to make sure, because there's some of us that don't read very well, Dr. Miller then drew a picture. I don't think you can see it from here. It's a tree with the roots down here labeled priesthood of believers. Then the bole of the tree, the trunk, is called public ministry. Then the branches, and there are three major divisions. The middle one is parish, and there you've got pastors, teachers, directors of education, parish workers, deaconesses, youth workers. Then there's another little side branch over here called a synod and districts, and there you have missionaries, professors, executives, editors, writers. And then the other major branch is called other individual or cooperative ventures, social work, caseworkers, chaplains, physicians, medical missionaries, nurses, high school teachers, teachers of the mentally retarded. He's got everybody on his tree. But if you see what he is saying, is that the pastoral office is not God's idea, as baptism is, where Jesus says, "Go ye therefore and baptize." or this do with in relation to the sacrament of the altar. He says, you don't have a clear statement in the Bible. I want you to have pastors from now till the end of time. But rather, all he says is, I want the gospel proclaimed. And in the New Testament, we have the obvious suggestion that if it's going to be done, human beings have to do it. And therefore, in freedom, the church through the ages develops various kinds of offices. Some slough off, some start again. We may have missionaries at one time. We may have deacons at one time. And different orders, but none of them is divinely ordained, but rather the office of the ministry. And this is where you get back to Walther. Walther did equate, I don't think there's any doubt about it, that's praedicant with the pastoral office, the preaching office, because he used the parallel term, das Pfarramt, which is very definitely the poimenes, the shepherding office, the Pfarrer. And Mary comes along and says, no, you can't do it. Now, these are the two conflicting positions that we have. So, Dr. Harm has heard all this before. He's been reading the confessions while I've been talking. We'll turn to the Augsburg Confession. And I won't read a lot of the confessions, but there's much to be said in these. The Article 5, and you open to page 31 and tap it, and you say, ha, now we're going to get the real goods, because Article 5 is entitled The Office of the Ministry. Now watch this. I don't know if you read it yet or paid attention to it. You know, you're beginning to lick your chops and figure, now this is really going to settle the issue. A.C. Moore, Walter, you know, they didn't know what they're talking about. And here's the definition. It's only a few lines in that article. To obtain such faith, which is talked about because Article 4 is justification, God instituted the office of the ministry. We're still saying, aha, here it comes. That is, provided the gospel and the sacraments. And you get, it's a letdown. Through these, as through means, he gives the Holy Spirit, who works faith when and where he pleases, in those who hear the gospel. And the gospel teaches that we have a gracious God, not by our own merits, but by the merit of Christ when we believe this. And condemned are the Anabaptists and others who teach that the Holy Spirit comes to us through our own preparations, thoughts, and works without the external word of the gospel. Then Dr. Tappert at that point knew we were going to be terribly disappointed because we wouldn't be looking for this. So he has a footnote. This title would be misleading. Would be if it were not observed, as the text of the article makes clear, that the reformers thought of, quote, the office of the ministry in other than clerical terms. So that doesn't help us. There are other places, and I won't have time to go in. You'd look into Apology 15, and certainly you discuss the power and primacy of the Pope. You look in there for clearer statements. But it was not the intention of the Augsburg Confession to settle our issue. So, Dr. Miller's view is that the office of the ministry is a general ordination of God which flows out of the priesthood of believers. The one single command is that the gospel must be proclaimed and the sacraments administered. As the situation demands, the church actualizes this ministry in concreto, in concrete, which has no reference to some preachers' heads, by arranging for various kinds or forms of ministry, pastor, teacher, missionary, parish workers, social workers. The essence of this argument is that while the office of the ministry is divinely ordained, thus praedicat amt is, thus hates the amt. In reference to, I think as the confessions discuss it, in comparison with, for instance, ritual. You know, this was the, and in Luther's day, that was what needed emphasizing. The important thing, the highest thing, is not who's got the fanciest chasuble. or who can scrape and bow the most, or who knows, who's memorized the liturgy best, or who can chant most beautifully. That's not the highest office in the church, all this garbage that had been developed, but das höchste Amt ist das Predigtamt, the proclamation of the word. And that's why Luther got in that pulpit and preached his heart out. And that's how the Reformation was so much strengthened. And this is, as Pastor Barth said today, that's how the church is still strengthened, by das Predigtamt, the proclamation. But it doesn't settle our immediate question. The office of pastor, according to this view, is a human arrangement, and thus is not in any way elevated above the office of teacher or any other office. I don't agree with it. I'm keeping an eye on the clock and also on how tired you're getting. A few references. Article 14 of the Augustana also comes in here. However, one of the briefest articles of the Augsburg Confession indicates that this egalitarian steamrollering is not what the reformers had in mind. That article reads, "It is taught among us that nobody should publicly teach or preach or administer the sacraments in the church without a regular call." So again, if one had the time to thoroughly examine the confessions, you would find that what has been called, I think is Dr. Armin Mollering, who gave us that beautiful lecture on homiletics last year, uses that term, the egalitarian steamrollering, that we say all offices are alike. So where are we? Obviously, the problem of what is a minister or what is a pastor or who is what in the church is a thorny issue. On the basis of Scripture, I think there are a number of things that we can say. First, by baptism, all believers are constituted as priests before God. All believers are priests. Not all believers are pastors. There's a difference. And I think some of the recent confusion has entered in from the well-meaning work that has been done. For instance, Hendrik Kramer's little book, The Theology of the Laity, which was so influential in the development of the mission affirmations. In fact, whole paragraphs are quoted. Or Georg Witzedom, a little book which has been translated called The Mission of God, where you had a strong emphasis on the theology of the laity, the activity of the laity, that God's pastors equip people for ministry, that we are all ministers. Which, you know, for those of us who still remembered Yelling Jiggers the Mini, was a little bit confusing suddenly to hear a pastor say, "You're all ministers." I think it was all well-meaning, but perhaps it did contribute to this egalitarian steamrollering, that a pastor is just another layman, only more so, or less so, or something. And those who read this material thoughtlessly, I think, picked it up at times and decided that it was not, you know, we didn't have such a thing as an office of the pastor. So every believer, to be sure, may approach God directly. More than this, however, every Christian is to be a proclaimer of the gospel, 1 Peter 4:9. Then you had, beyond that, to show God's will, the apostolate. God definitely chose the apostles. The commission of Matthew 28 to make disciples of all nations was first given to the 11. The once-for-allness of this circle is respected when a replacement is made for Judas. Paul also bases his claim to equality with the original band on his vision of the resurrected Lord. 1 Corinthians 15, you know how Paul makes a big fuss about this in Galatians. I am an apostle. And you can just see why Paul, in his opening verses so often, says, Paulus, Dulus, Apostolus, Jesu Christu. He wanted no mistake. I'm not speaking to you as buddy-buddy. I am speaking to you by the full authority of the Lord as an apostle of the Lord. And the concept and function of apostle is basically unique. And therefore, we don't base the pastoral ministry on the apostolate. The reason we bring it up here is to indicate that God was interested in offices, in establishing offices. The New Testament, and this is sort of an interesting sidelight which could be pursued, extends the usage of the apostle, the word apostle, to others besides the original 12. So at that time, there was kind of an extension to some of the assistants of the apostles. But the point is, the pastoral office is sui generis. It is unique. And here we meet the pith of the argument. The power of the keys is originally and immediately possessed by the whole people of God. Matthew 16, Matthew 18. The administration of the office of the keys is by divine arrangement committed to certain men, chosen by the people of God, who thus exercise God's will in calling men who meet God's qualifications, 1 Timothy 3 and elsewhere, to publicly exercise and administer the office. So my position would be that indeed the office of the pastorate, the office of the pastor is indeed unique, that it is not merely a historical evolution which then the church later sort of baptized and said, okay, that's the way we want to do it, that from the very beginning, God has decided and has committed to his church. We might wish, as some have said, for clearer passages than we have for this, but the scriptural evidence is convincing. That the whole business, anything that we do or say which furthers the proclamation of the gospel, is what we term the ministry, and therefore everybody gets in it. But it still leaves the pastoral office out on a limb. The other side insists that the one necessary and unique office of the church is that of pastor to a local flock. Other than that, the church may create and abolish various offices as the situation warrants. Even here, however, none should presume to function on behalf of the church without a formal request and commissioning by the church. That is a call. Now, this, I think, is where you have to start to establish the authority. Coming back to the uniqueness of the pastoral office, I don't know if that might be a good topic for your bull sessions. I'll share with you my thinking about it. I believe that the uniqueness inheres not in the fact that only the pastor preaches the gospel. That's hard to prove. In fact, it's patently false. Sunday school teacher does it. The teacher does it in the schoolroom. He better, if he's proclaiming, you know, being a Christian to proclaim the Christian faith. The uniqueness, I think, does not inhere in merely celebrating the sacrament, but it inheres in the authority and responsibility. And this is enough to blow your mind a little bit and keep you awake at night when you say, I want to become a pastor. The responsibility and accountability and the authority that goes with it for the faith of other people. As we have in Hebrews, for instance, obey those who have the rule over you, that they may do it with joy and not with sorrow, for they must give account. And it seems to me that as we look at God's plan, he wanted each congregation to have somebody who was uniquely trained, because he lists the qualifications, and who would assume this frightening responsibility of saying, what these people believe is my responsibility. And that therefore the major function of the pastor, maybe the school teacher can preach better than he can. So what? Because the uniqueness of his office does not lie in the fluency of his speaking. But what is taught in Sunday school, what is taught in his school, what is believed in his home, in the homes of his parish, what is proclaimed in that public service, wherever, is his responsibility. And therefore, the necessity for his knowing the Word of God better than anybody else, and the necessity for his giving attention to doctrine. No pastor has the right before God to be sloppy in his doctrine, because more than his own faith is at stake. He is called to be a Plemenic, a shepherd, who sees what people, what kind of doctrine they're consuming and what is happening to their faith. And I think it's at that point, if people would only understand this and relate the various offices in the church to that, it's not merely that the pastor is supposed to know everything that's going on. He has the general supervision. That may be true, but that's mostly an economic matter, that most churches can only afford one full-time man, and so he's got to run the show. But it seems to me the uniqueness is in the accountability. So at this point, I'm sure you realize that the theological issue can be a difficult one. Regarding the office of the ministry, a number of positions have developed in the course of the church's history. We have the various points of view regarding the nature of the ministry, the ontological, the functional, and the office. And it seems to me that God is saying that where people gather together, it is his will, and it is his gracious will, his good will, that this office be established so that the flock will remain faithful and will be properly fed. The uniqueness of the pastoral office has not one whit to do with any superiority of persons. Galatians 3:28 is indeed very pertinent, that in Christ there is neither male nor female, young, old, black, white, or anything else, pastor, teacher, janitor, or anything else. All believers are equal in God's sight. No Christian person is superior to another. And where within a congregation, a pastor assumes that his office means that he personally is superior, I think that's where the sparks begin to fly. In order to provide guidance to the church, God has ordained a pastoral ministry. Its uniqueness lies in its responsibility for the faith of members of the flock. There is a hierarchy of office, but absolutely no elitism of person. By reason of his call, the pastor occupies a special office as he carries out the highest function of the Great Commission. He is not, by reason of his ordination, invested with an indelible character at all. And finally, just a few remarks on, from a pastoral theological point of view. Pastoral hubris is always out of place. The idea, ich bin der Herr Pastor, has never worked. It is the office which is elevated and not the person. And the mood of John the Baptist is most fitting when we, in great humility and fear at times, assume the office of pastorate. He must increase and I must decrease. Relationships and efficiency among holders of the various church offices are at their best when the Spirit is ruling in the hearts of those who serve. Then the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and so on. Where human pride and the spirit of competitiveness enters, trouble will also enter. The pastor must serve as pastor to those who serve with him. This means he must take responsibility for the faith, doctrine, and life of his fellow servants. For instance, if there's a school faculty in a congregation, the pastor must work hard to teach and guide his staff of teachers in doctrine, and too little of that is done. The school is over here and the preacher's out here, and he doesn't meet with the faculty. He carries on no form of continuing education with them, and they just go their own way. And what is taught in the school gets taught, and the pastor frequently, the thing just deteriorates. He's afraid to visit the school because it'll cause trouble. In the meantime, the faculty is complaining because he doesn't visit the school. It's this kind of breakdown and a failure to realize the coordination. The whole concept of subordination must be appreciated. Scriptural concept of hypotage in no way refers to people lording it over other people. It has nothing to do with it. Superiority, inferiority of persons. And a very thorough exegetical study of that remarkable word indicates that what we're talking about here is God's concept of order. Yes, indeed, there has to be a hierarchy of office, even as there is an egalitarianism of persons. So the pastor and his professional helpers constitute an egalitarian hierarchy. One must be careful to be egalitarian in the right categories and hierarchical only in the appropriate areas. There is a hierarchy of offices. The sweep of the pendulum can be kept within the range of harmonious collaboration between pastor and associates as it swings between the extremes of tolerable tension and ecstatic concord. And probably ecstatic concord, where you have people who still have the flesh, is never to be expected on this faculty or any other faculty or in any parish. The pendulum controls the orderly operation of the machinery so that springs do not wildly unwind, accomplishing nothing. There may be tensions because of the imperfections and weaknesses present still in the believer's flesh, but it will be tolerable. There will be concord because of the Spirit's presence and power, and it will be ecstatic. Well, those are a few thoughts on this thorny issue, and I guess if you discovered that it's more complicated than you thought at first, my purpose has been accomplished.
Gushin, so just remember to go to the mic when you have a question.
Last year when the issue of the theological day of reflection was the ordination of women, Dr. Scare, or Professor Scare, whatever he is, implied, I believe, and I'm sorry he's not here to tell me how wrong I undoubtedly am, I believe he implied that he saw the uniqueness of the ministry in the preaching and proclaiming office, or the function. And on this, then, he based his contention based on the verses from Timothy and so forth that women should not hold authority, teaching authority and preaching authority in the church. If, as you say, the uniqueness of the office is in the accountability and responsibility that a pastor has for the souls of the members of the congregation, how does this then, or what I should say, why then could a woman not exercise or hold that responsibility or accountability?
Yeah. I think that, as I recall Dr. Scare's emphasis, he comes at it from a different way. I think it comes out the same, because his emphasis was on defining what you meant by speaking in the church. And he had quite an exegetical study to indicate that that was not merely speaking in the church in the sense of somebody getting up and talking, but that the term included, as I would put it, speaking with a sense of your responsibility for determining the faith of other people. I think it comes out pretty much the same way. And that that kind of thing, which is involved in this basic responsibility of the pastoral office, is by God in St. Paul's writings restricted. I don't know if that gets to it or not, but it seemed to me what he was saying is that the kind of speaking which we're referring to is indeed pastoral speaking. Whether it's as fluent as somebody else, it may even be the same words that somebody else uses. But the very fact that a pastor is saying them includes this responsibility.
As I understood, your primary reason for uniqueness of the pastoral office or for the pastor, you said there was the responsibility for the faith of his flock. That raised the question in my mind, because it seemed to me, if I were to answer that question, I would come out, the thing that popped up my mind first was the concept of the call, that the pastor was the concept of his call was the thing that made him unique. And I wondered, now this isn't maybe directly what you've been assigned to talk about, but I just wonder if there seems to be quite a bit of confusion, at least in my mind anyway, about the concept of the call. Whether, for example, all Christians are called, or whether just a few are called to be pastors, I'm sure you can get into very broad discussion about that, but anyway, the uniqueness of the pastoral ministry seemed to me, at least in part, on the call.
Yeah, except I don't think it's unique. for the very reason that you mentioned that the term is used in so many different ways. Certainly a teacher has a call, and depending on how broadly you want to use it. But I would say again, the call to what? That's the uniqueness, to what he is called to. That would be my emphasis. But I would agree wholeheartedly with you that our nomenclature, some of which is purely an adiaphorum, it doesn't matter. There's no scripture command, even the word ordain. We can ordain anybody. But at that point, we begin to say, well, what are you doing to the church by throwing this term around this way? Because there is a tradition, and there's a general, stop anybody on the street whether he's a Christian or not, and ask him if he knows what an ordained person is, and he's thinking of a clergyman. So I think with the call likewise. But we do have to say the congregation has the right, in order to carry out the function of the office of the keys, which is given to it, to call anybody to do anything it wants it to do. And I think this is where we professors ground our call. The congregations banded together have said, among other things, we want our theological students taught. And therefore we call you. And the board of control of the institution merely is representing, because they've been elected by the synod, they're merely representing the congregations whom we're serving. So I don't think we're in disagreement, except I want to take a step farther back to make it even more unique. Because I guess I would maintain that the school teacher, I wouldn't go as far as Eckhart goes in saying it's none of the teacher's business to perform any spiritual services for the kid outside the classroom. I think that's bad. But I think I would go as far as to say that the primary responsibility for that child's faith is the pastor's and not the teacher's. Now, in performing his office, the teacher is likewise. But ultimately, it seems to me this whole concept of shepherd, and there's much more scriptural evidence that needs to be adduced. I realize that very much. There are many passages. But that it's the Lord's will that there be shepherds of the flock. And just as the shepherd was responsible that his flock didn't fall over cliffs and that the wolves didn't get them and everything else, so we carry our shepherd's crook, our staff, as the symbol of our office. And that flock is committed to us. It's not given to us. It's not my congregation. It's God's congregation. But my call includes more. That is, if I'm a pastor, my call is very specific in what it obligates me to do. I think the ordination and installation rituals kind of bring this out, too. If we listen carefully, and usually you're pretty excited, it's like the day you get married, you don't hear anything anybody says. You ought to read that stuff once in a while about 2 months later. The terrific responsibility. It's enough to drive you to your knees in prayer again and again and again. Because someday my Sunday school teachers won't be standing before God and answering the question, where are they? But I will. Now, you could also talk about the terrific responsibility God lays upon parents. But here's a unique thing that nobody else can say, even though they do everything that a pastor does. When the chips are down, the buck stops with him. And all I can say is, if you don't want that responsibility, then we need some good bricklayers. It's a sobering thought, and yet when you get all through with it, it's at that point that you can begin to say, now I see why this is such a high and noble office. Who is worthy of it? Not I, surely. And yet in his mercy, God has overcome even my weakness and called me to it. And I think that makes that concept that you have makes for an excellent relationship among the various people serving in the congregation, and it sure gets you out of bed in the morning. and it sure gets you in your car to visit in the hospital. And it sure gets you out of bed in the middle of the night when somebody calls and says, Grandma Schmidt's dying. You don't say, well, I'm sorry, I'll see her in the morning. Because this terrific shepherding responsibility, which is at the same time your burden and your ultimate glory. Okay.
Further questions?
Yes.
Jim, I think...
Dr. Schultz, as you were talking, I was trying to, and this may be more of just an observation rather than a question, trying to bring together the equalitarian of roles or ministry, people, persons, as over against the hierarchy of office, which is for order. And I've heard the word used shepherd, and as I was listening to the word shepherd, so oftentimes when you're given that responsibility, you can sense a tendency to take and run with that. So you come out with a hair pastor at times.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, another image popped into my mind as you were talking, and that was servant. And as a servant, taking up the theme of Jesus when he took the towel and washed the disciples' feet, that we were encouraged and commanded to do likewise, that taking this role of responsibility and placing alongside of it the image of servant, and therefore we become servant of servants.
Yeah. That's an excellent observation, and that's where it really works. I've seen beautiful situations where pastors and teachers got along fine. They loved each other. They showed concern for each other. But they knew their office. One of the saddest things that I have seen happen, and it's happened too many times, is you'd be talking to a teacher or a principal. And maybe this sometimes is what the church has done to people. And he starts bragging. You know what happened to me? The pastor let me read the gospel last Sunday. And you can just see him out there with that used choir robe on, glorying in that great moment. And what breaks your heart is, why isn't he talking to you about his teaching? Is he trying to grasp at the fringes of an office which the church has elevated and has put down his office so that he takes greater pride in fiddling around with the edges of another office than in the heart and core of his own? Or, and I've seen that, and it really is heartbreaking. And it's at that point that I ask, what has our church done to these people in 125 years that we haven't even found a decent title for them? I think it was bad when we gave up the German Der Lehrer or Herr Lehrer. We don't hear that too much anymore. It was the best we could do. But even that would still be good if we would refer to them not as Mr. How come pastors got to be reverend and teachers are suddenly Mr.? And maybe we ought to revive again that title of honor and office, Teacher Schmidt. It might help.
Jim was next.
What should the relationship be between a pastor and the elders of a congregation?
Okay. They represent the congregation, and they are elected by the congregation to assist the pastor, and if they're the proper kind of elder, it depends on the constitution, particularly in the spiritual duties of the pastor. And therefore, I would say they are indeed assistants to the pastor. Where they're properly trained, they can do a lot of the spiritual things. They can even, I would say, they can even assist the pastor in making sick calls, hospital calls, evangelism calls, shut-in calls and whatnot, or anything that has to do with the spiritual concerns. But they do it under the direction, the supervision of the pastor, and he ultimately is the pastor. They don't become assistant pastors. Neither is a school teacher an assistant pastor, but they may all be assistants to him. And I think, again, if they're properly trained and used, they can be a real blessing. In too many cases, they're elected and they just sit as members of the church council, and they're not much different from the trustees or deacons or somebody. But they ought to be people of, I would say, properly done, the elders should be most carefully selected. They should be men of maturity, because frequently they're going to be involved even with some rather private matters. And therefore, they need to be the finest, most spiritually mature people. But there, too, and you get back to Ephesians 4, that the pastor is given by God to equip them. And the training of elders should be one of the major functions of the parish pastor.
There's a book that I read some time ago which is entitled, If I Had But One Sermon to Preach. And I wonder if I could impose upon speakers today to given us in just as brief a compass some kind of last word, not dying word, I hope, but one last word to us that might summarize what you'd like to have us take home and cogitate upon. Dr. Schultz, why don't you begin?
Okay, sounds kind of fatal or something. Yeah. I guess I would summarize it in this way, what we've been doing today as you reflect theologically, is that you do daily consider your ministry, that which you now have and that to which you aspire, so that you take it seriously. I think one of the great problems in the church today has been a downgrading of the ministry. And most of the blame, I think, falls on the occupants of the office, not only through their misbehavior at times, and that sometimes is very shocking, but even through the way they speak of their office, as if it's another job, and certainly we'll take a call if the salary is higher, and all of these mean things have entered in. And I think that as well as maintaining purity of doctrine, maintaining the administration of the sacraments, realizing that this is the Lord's arrangement, we should value it highly. And if we do, then our relationship to other people who work with us will be one of love. And the ministry can be a happy time. It can be a miserable life if we make it so. But it can also be a glorious way to spend that little time that you're here on this earth, until someday in heaven there will be stars in your crown.
The Department of Practical Theology has been very much involved in our convocation today. I think that we've been feasting upon two excellent examples of practical theology, where the rubber is hitting the road. And for all of us, I'd like to say to each of you, Pastor Barth and Dr. Schultz, thank you.